You think he got anything out of all that, or?
I doubt it.
Okay.
I like that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, you sort of caught us in a rather intimate moment there, staring into each other's eyes. I'm Dustin Bass.
And I'm Alan Joaquin.
Uh-huh.
Intimate.
What in the world is going on with the glasses? Okay, next season, just go Kareem Abdul-Jabbar just wear goggles.
I went and got...
Just wear prescription goggles.
I went to go see the eye doctor. This past week, in fact, and so I'll be getting some new glasses.
Yeah.
And in fact, what I will wear on this show will be the progressives. I know we don't like to use that word around here, but they're called progressives, right. So that I can look at, my notes and look at the camera and look at the guest and, unfortunately, look at you just wear the pair the whole time.
That is what I call progress.
Because I don't want to sit and, so
yeah, and I don't want you to.
But I'm getting two pair of readers, regular readers, and then the progressives, which I'll be wearing on this show when they'll be here next season.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think that's what we're gonna change our name to: the Progressives.
The Progressive Sons.
The Progressives of History.
Yeah, the Sons of Progressive History.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is our final episode of the third season. Thank you so much for joining us for the episodes. If this is your first time to be checking us out, well, you got plenty to listen to and watch.
Yeah, lots of podcasts.
We had a lot of great guests.
We did. This
season.
Yeah, you did a damn good job.
Just say I do everything.
Well, I mean, I did. I did tell you to turn on the lights, so you did turn on.
Yes,
the lights.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, I brought Dr. Stephen Brumwell.
That is true. You did get one.
Didn't
you try to get him last season?
Well, that was,
So you more or less have gotten one guest in two seasons.
Well.
Now, I will say this. You got Stephen Brumwell this season. You got Michael Walsh last season. You got Alex Kershaw the first season. You get...
I had
one guest each season.
Hold on, Dr. Stephen Harden. I got him.
That's true.
Okay, and we've had him twice.
Kershaw and Stephen Harden.
Dr. Mary Graybar, that was me.
Was that you?
That was me.
You sure?
I'm positive. I'm positive. I'm the one who reached out to her.
Okay.
So I've gotten us some pretty good guests.
All right. You're pulling some weight.
Yeah.
So. I didn't even realize that you were, because I've been carrying so much of it.
I didn't even know
that you were carrying any of it.
What about...
it's sort of like,
Oh, wait. Wesley Odom. I brought Wesley Odom in. I got... is it Stephen Haskell? I know he's going to kill me. I hope he's not watching this video.
Stephen Haskell?
What's the guy's name?
We never had a Stephen Haskell.
No, the guy that was with the Frederick Douglass. He does all those
reenactments. You're talking about John McCaskill?
John McCaskill, yes.
You are a...
Sorry, John. But I brought John McCaskill. I was the one who brought him. I was the one of them.
And I think you'd probably want us to say McCaskill.
McCaskill?
Anyways, all right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, final episode of the season. We will not see you in the studio until September of this year. We're taking the rest of the summer off. But to end us off, we've got a really great guest to talk about civics education. And I think this is a really good time to do this conversation. Now that the school year is over, parents who are considering, hey, what am I going to do with kids? Am I going to have them go into public education, private education, homeschool? You'll have plenty of source material to either, if you decide to go homeschool, you have plenty of source material for history and civics. And two, if you decide to go public education or private education, this will be a good way to, I guess, advocate for better history and civics in your own school. This open doors up.
Yeah,
what you can know about.
In fact, when we do the book recommendations, I'm not doing just one book. I'm going to actually do several.
Yeah.
Kind of lay the foundation. And our guest will bring up stuff that I think is going to be very important that kind of overall solidifies everything. So,
absolutely.
So yeah, stay tuned to the end. We'll present our books, and then that way, if you do want to homeschool your children or you want to have discussions with people, you'll know some of the books that we recommend. And also, if you get a chance, subscribe to us on our YouTube channel. We have plenty of material so that, you know, you can go back and watch many of our episodes, or you can like us on Facebook. But I think the good ones, we have them all on YouTube. So subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram.
Man, you hit that early.
I did. Yeah. I think we should do that.
And while you're at it, join our email newsletter. So just shoot us your email. At thesonsofhistory@gmail.com. Speaking of, the documentary, the Road Trip documentary, part one is coming out on the 25th of this month. So Wednesday, just a couple of days from now, be sure to check out our YouTube channel because our trip to the birthplace of Dwight D. Eisenhower is going to be out. And then probably about 2 weeks later, a week or two later, going to do the birthplace of Chester Nimitz. So that was fun. We had a good time doing that.
Yeah, we did. Oh, that really was. I enjoyed, the two towns alone.
Yeah. I ran into a lot of really cool people.
And, you know, and all those businesses that we went to, all the good food, the drinks, the hospitality was just incredible in both towns. And then you had the museums, which were... really, you know, and then you got us at the interview with a 4-star Marine general, the commandant. That was pretty cool.
That was pretty sweet. Yeah. So, but you carried a lot of weight with that one too. You remember that one thing that you did?
The equipment that I carried?
Yeah.
The heavy equipment I carried? Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember that.
You really did a lot.
Hey, you know what? I traveled.
I think this is just an episode for me to complain about.
I traveled across the Southeast United States, and then I did the Gulf Coast campaign. I really appreciate, you know, all the help, you know, the gas money, the hotel expenses. Oh, wait, I did all that.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, you know, and I just did a road trip, and I'm about to
You do know that you took a vacation, and your vacation was... to go do that.
Well, yes. And I could have taken a vacation and go lay out on a beach someplace.
But well, maybe next time do that.
Well, and, you know.
Maybe you'll utilize your equipment a little bit better than you did on your trip.
You know, I think this is a really good time for us to talk about This Week in History.
Okay. All right. Well, my selection for This Week in History is May 25th, 1787. I think this goes right in line with what we're going to be talking about today. So this is when the Constitutional Convention officially got started. Officially got started. They had planned to start it on May 14th, but they didn't have enough people there. So they had to wait it out. Obviously, travel was a bit different than it is now, so it took a little bit more time. The Constitutional Convention takes place in Philadelphia, lasts throughout the summer. A lot of debates go on. If you want to get an eyewitness account, bird's eye view, fly on the wall, read James Madison's notes on the debates of the Constitutional Convention. Really, really good. I can't encourage people enough to read that. And then if you want to figure out, hey, how does it all look post-Constitutional Convention? Read the Federalist Papers. Little wink and a nod to my book and movie recommendation. Anyways, lasted throughout the summer. First state to ratify the Constitution.
Rhode Island?
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah. Delaware was the first state to ratify. Rhode Island was the last state to ratify in 1790, almost three years, almost to the day of when the Constitutional Convention got started. So May 29th, 1790, is when Rhode Island decided, let's go ahead and do this. But we didn't really need Rhode Island to do it in order to ratify the Constitution because they were the 13th state to do so. We only needed 9. New Hampshire was the 9th state, and We have the Constitution, longest living constitution in world history, longest living constitution as of today, the most beautiful piece of work in American history, along with the Declaration of Independence, and Body by Jake Alan Joaquin.
You know, you should mention the
fact. Did you ever do Body by Jake?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did. I did. Well, it was, I purchased it for I purchased it for my parents.
Yeah.
And
I always did the sit and be fit.
I didn't. I also did that. No, I didn't do it. I'm joking. Remember the Suzanne Summers one where? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was. I liked the commercials, but I didn't care for the product.
Itself, I liked the headbands.
But yeah, I gave my parents that, and they used it. They did use it. So you should mention also that the United States was ruled under the Articles of Confederation.
That's right. AOC wasn't working.
Yeah. Shay's Rebellion kind of showed.
That's why they got together. Yeah. AOC.
Yeah. We were not a republic until.
That's right. We were a confederate.
Yeah. Confederate states. Confederation. Yeah. Confederation of states. But Benjamin Franklin coined that term. You know, what'd you give us? A republic if you can keep it, or if we can keep it, whatever it was.
Right.
So, all right, so mine is going to be, fast forward many years, has absolutely nothing to do with our discussion. It's World War II, actually.
Oh, surprise, surprise. You know what, I'd like to take a poll or figure out the ratio.
Wait a minute, I did a medieval.
Ratio
wait,
of
I,
World I, War II versus everything else.
I did a medieval one last week. The marriage of the future
did.
King Henry II with Eleanor of Aquitaine.
I know you did.
Who gave us Richard the Lionheart and John Lackland, King John.
All right, go on.
Robin Hood.
Remember, this episode is just me complaining about you.
All right, which I'm going to complain about your neighbors and that idiot that was blocking me. So, and I just sat there and I'm like, nope, I'm not moving. And he had to drive up the curb, which was funny, you know. Anyway, yeah, he blinked, not I. Kind of like that beginning of this episode.
Rebel without a cause.
Yes. All right. So mine is going to be one of, I'm going to say it probably is the greatest naval chase in the history of warfare. It was the great chase against the Bismarck. Nazi Germany's the Bismarck. So the Germans built two very powerful battleships, the Bismarck and the Tirpitz. They were sister ships. Now, the Bismarck left Hamburg, and it was spotted by a British reconnaissance plane, a Spitfire, in one of the Norwegian fjords near Bergen. Took a picture of it and the Prince Eugen, and the Spitfire flew back. And it was pretty interesting story how the information. They ran out of fuel. There was another plane they had to take. And they had to drive through the night. You know, they had blackouts, 50-some miles an hour in the middle of the night with no headlights. Got the information out, and the British Admiralty decided, hey, we need to, you know, the Bismarck is going to be a major threat. So Bismarck and Prinz Eugen, they left together, and so they sent the British ships, the Hood and the Prince of Wales. There were a couple of cruisers, the Norfolk and the Suffolk, that shadowed the Bismarck. Bismarck opened fire on them, missed. Now, they didn't know where the Bismarck was going to go, but there were predictions that it was going into Denmark Strait, which is between Greenland and Iceland, which is what it did. And the Hood, which was their greatest ship, the Hood and the Prince of Wales intercepted both of them. So on the morning of May 24th, around 5:52, the British opened fire. And within 7 minutes, the Hood kind of moved broadside so that it could open fire all its guns on the Bismarck and Prinz Eugen. Well, that was kind of a bad move because as they maneuvered, what they didn't realize was the Germans had already fired these rounds. And one round landed in the one of the magazines of the Hood. Mm. The Hood blew up. I mean, just exploded. And there were, I believe there were 1,514 men killed when the Hood blew up. That was at 5:59. It was like after 7 minutes.
Yeah.
So 1,415 British sailors were killed, including, I think his name was Admiral Holland. Three survivors. That's it. There were only three survivors. So the hood blows up, and now it was just the Prince of Wales against the Bismarck and the Prince Eugen. And, you know, the Prince of Wales fired a few rounds and then just hightailed it out of there. They threw a smoke screen and got out. So the news just shocked the world. Germany was delighted. The British were shocked. So Winston Churchill gave orders. Sink the Bismarck. So they sent everything against the Bismarck and the Prince Eugen. There was an aircraft carrier, Ark Royal, launched these swordfish. They were called swordfish with torpedoes. They were biplanes. They were attacking destroyers, cruisers. Everybody was attacking. They really couldn't do it. But this one swordfish launched a torpedo, and that torpedo hit the rudder. And that spelled the end of the Bismarck. Now, it didn't sink, but it couldn't really go anywhere. And the British ships just kind of swarmed around the Bismarck. The Prince Eugen got away. It made it back to France. But everyone, all the British, they were sending more swordfish planes, more ships, just firing, firing, firing. Finally, on May the 27th, the Bismarck sank. Now, there is evidence that the Germans scuttled the ship themselves. You know, the British just devastated the entire ship, but the actual sinking was done by the Germans. Regardless, the Bismarck sank on May the 27th, and out of 2,224 men, only 118 survived.
On the Bismarck?
On the Bismarck. Yeah. So they were in the process of rescuing the sailors, and then somebody spotted a German U-boat telescope, and they hightailed it out of there, left everybody behind. So, yeah, it was one of the greatest naval chases, naval actions in the history of warfare. They even made a movie called Sink the Bismarck.
Do you think they really saw a telescope?
Yeah, I think they
Periscope?
Did. Yeah, I think they did. I don't know if there was a U-boat, but somebody saw it. And
somebody saw something.
And they just abandoned. There's a pretty sick story about what happened to some people that were clinging to the nets, which I won't mention. You can read about it, but wasn't a good scene. But
No, not at all. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that is This Week in History. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we've got a very special guest. His name is David Randall. He is the Director of Research at the National Association of Scholars and Project Director of the Civics Alliance. He is the co-author of No Longer a City on a Hill, Massachusetts Degrades Its K-12 History Standards, and he is the author of several studies, including Making Citizens, How American Universities Teach Civics, and the one we'll be discussing today, Learning for Self-Government, a K-12 civics report card. Without further ado, are you ready, Doctor?
I am ready, Doctor. Yeah, I think it's going to be a good discussion.
Let us perform surgery. So help me God, if you lean away from that microphone during our talk, I will, right in the middle of everything, I will square up and punch you.
Yeah, you know, I really would like to see.
I would like to see it,
I'm going to get my little, you know, wireless next time.
Yeah, well, let's quit screwing around. David, how are you doing, man?
Fine, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Hey, we're excited to have you. I know that you're excited and we're both excited because civics is something that Alan and I discuss a lot, like as far as the deficiency of civics education across the board in this country, in particular in public schools. So I assume that you have sort of this same feeling or idea, since the reason you wrote or you put this study together, Learning of Self-Government, right?
Yeah. And I should say, people across the spectrum, political spectrum, are aware that there is something gravely wrong with our civics education. There are different prescriptions for what to do about it. And in fact, what I am saying is that there is a great deal of stuff on the radical end of the political spectrum, which is doubling down on what's going wrong. So it's not enough to say what there's something wrong. It's also saying what is wrong and what do you do to make it better.
Yeah. Now, before we jump into your study that you did, you're with the Pioneer Institute and you're also with the National Association of Scholars. A friend of ours, probably mutual. Wilford McClay we had on last season. Name drop. But anyways, tell us a little bit about the Pioneer Institute and the National Association of Scholars.
I am actually with the National Association of Scholars and also policy director for our Civics Alliance. This was written jointly for the Pioneer Institute and then the National Association of Scholars. The Pioneer Institute is interested in public policy in Massachusetts in particular, including education policy in particular. So, you know, this is like the second report I have written associated for the Pioneer Institute. Frankly, they're good guys, but I'm actually myself at NAS, so I know more about what we do, which is in particular education reform for higher education in particular, you know, the undergraduate version, you know, academic freedom, bringing back teaching Western civilization. We're also doing more and more, however, on K-12 education, particularly civics, which is how this report got done.
Okay.
Now, I wanted to ask you this one question, but before I do, I had another question, having read your material. Moderation, is it good? Is it bad? Is it a vice? Is it a virtue? What is it?
It's something we really need. No, look, this is fascinating. So we are at a point in our republic where people are deeply sure of themselves and rather intolerant. I myself am a great fan of Barry Goldwater. You know, extremism in the defense of liberty is no virtue. You know, moderation in the defense is, you know, no vice, or vice other way around. Anyway, it's the classic statement for if to be moderate in a good cause is not necessarily a good thing. However, we are at this point chock-a-block full of people who have internalized that. Frankly, I think the danger is farther from the progressive left, but all of us need to step back a moment and say, it is a good thing to be moderate, even in what you believe most deeply. This is part of what makes for a republic where we care deeply about our convictions, but one of our deepest convictions is that we keep the republic itself going and that we compromise moderately, even on our deepest convictions, to make sure that the republic and all the citizens in it can continue to work together to, you know, to keep our mutual liberty guaranteed by a republic of liberty in good shape.
Okay, so it's kind of something that I follow, where don't try to shove your beliefs down someone's throat, because you're going to have people that just aren't going to necessarily agree with you all the time.
You have to know when to stand up as a prophet for your beliefs and when to work for them moderately. You know, one of those things is, we're getting this actually in the Supreme Court right now. How do you deal with people who disagree with you on the substance in a Supreme Court decision? You know, among other things, you're supposed to have the sense you don't go and, you know, you mob their private residences. You're supposed to have the sense of moderation that you stick back and say, I may disagree deeply with their jurisprudence, but I'm not going to try to make their private lives unlivable. That moderation is knowing there's a sphere for political disagreement, you know, rules of the game, and you don't try to move to open war based on your political beliefs.
Okay. That
makes so sense. I got a question regarding moderation, because moderation on your convictions, and like what Alan was saying, like, we're not fans of either side trying to shove anything, any viewpoints down people's throats. You present your argument and then that's it. Is it moderation that you are advocating for citizens? Just citizens, or are you advocating moderation for legislators and judges as well? But let's stick with legislators. As legislators, when it comes to compromise, so you have these convictions, because a conviction that a senator or a representative has may not even necessarily be their own conviction, but it is the conviction of their constituents. So are you saying, and for the sake of moderation, let's sort of compromise to an extent the convictions of your constituents in order to somewhat preserve, in a sense, the Republic? Or is it a pursuit of peace when it comes to conversation? Like, where should you draw the line on the moderation? Just citizens or legislators as well?
Look, we all need it. I mean, some of the most famous parts of American history are the compromises of 1820 and 1850, which were done between people who wanted slavery to continue and to expand and people who wanted liberty, you know, to have, you know, a higher place in the nation. And we need to remember the immense moral value of keeping the United States together, even over ultimately irreconcilable moral understandings of the universe. And in effect, the people who compromised get too much of a bad name. You know, ultimately we had the war, ultimately liberty won. This is, you know, a good thing. At the same time, we need to recognize there was very great moral value in not casually casting the United States into a civil war and trying to keep peace between citizens, you know, with these very deep moral, conflicting moral intuitions. And we have forgotten, I think, too much the value of, you know, compromise, you know, out of a love of the lives of our fellow citizens. There's always a question, when is it appropriate to compromise? When should you not compromise? And, you know, you can't come up with it. It's always going to be case by case. I think perhaps the most important thing, however, is that you approach politics not casting the other person as a villain to be punished as much as possible, but to say they're your moral and legitimate equal, with whom you are engaging in a good faith effort to try to do the best you can for the nation. You start with the assumption that even somebody who disagrees with you deeply is ultimately your partner in trying to keep the Republic and the nation going, not, as I say, simply an enemy to be defeated. That's the presumption that allows, is for moderation and is the root of moderation.
Now, we have government and we have social studies. Now, how do they differ from, you know, the... you know, your new study, the Learning for Self-Government. I mean, what's your goal? How does it differ? What's your goal?
So I should say, so Learning for Self-Government is a particular review of different civics organizations and resources, grading them on how good they are, where, in fact, there is the group of people who are substituting action civics, progressive activism and vocational training for it and calling it civics. This is what we grade as being D's and F's. And this is Generation Citizen, the 1619 Project. You know, others, you know, I mentioned the Tisch School for Civic Life or some such name, you know, a university, you know, center doing this. And it really is nothing but what they call civics is political activism skewed in one political direction only. That's quite different from a variety of resources which are engaged in civics education, where in fact they're rather good people. I give the highest praise to the Hillsdale 1776 curriculum, and stuff like We the People, which is trying to be a nonpartisan textbook. I think that they are compromising a bit too much, speaking of moderation. But they have a good, solid civics textbook. But I should say this is part of a larger project, the Civics Alliance, which is interested in restoring a good civics education to the nation. This review is one part of that larger project, which includes stuff like model legislation, standards reform, and so forth.
Well, okay, so you mentioned the 1619 Project, so that's going to lead up to my next question.
Now, because we're big fans.
Yes, of
course. Huge fans.
You know, your privilege, your white privilege is just irritating me right now.
I know, and I appreciate that.
Well, okay, so now, so the left's replacement of civics knowledge with the civics activism that you had mentioned. We have, and we've talked about this, you have the Frankfurt School, you have Howard Zinn, CRT. It seems like schools are embracing and putting a preference to hormone blockers and anything BLM and the LGBTQ, CIA, FBI, plus, minus, for what they find more important than anything else that's going to unify the country. How are we going to compete with them, and how will you be able to succeed when this is being pushed more than anything else?
So the plug for this particular product, this review of the civics, is meant to say there is a lot of existing resources out there, ranging from teacher training, you know, the Ashbrook Center, the Jack Miller Center, to individual lesson plans, some of the stuff coming out of the Bill of Rights Institute, to sequences. 1776 Unites has great sequences on Black history, you know, to entire curricula. And the point is, all this good stuff exists. You can use it as a positive model and not just critique what's coming out of the education establishment. That's really important. We're not starting from ground zero. There's a lot of stuff out there. You can build upon it. I will say more broadly, what is needed is, oh gosh, effort both on the local level, school boards, school districts, then the states. There's a great deal of state legislation that can be done to reassert control over the public K-12 schools, the charter schools. And then ultimately, you do need to have action on the federal level, because unfortunately, a great deal of federal money and bureaucratic regulations are supporting this current revolution. So you need to work on all levels. I guess I would say for the moment, it needs to be done at the local and state levels first, if only because the federal government is a slow moving beast at the best of times. You need to work with what you can get immediate success on.
When it comes to getting into the schools and getting into writing these textbooks, and they're already being embraced by activist groups that are not really focused on actual civics education, how do you convince local and state, I guess, governments to actually embrace what you guys are doing when, and this is a long question, I know, when the left is saying, hey, this is activism, don't embrace this, and you're trying to fight activism at the same time. Does that make sense? Like, how do you get into that and make a change?
So I'm going to start with an answer first, which is good work is already being done. The two states that I think really deserve pride of place are Florida, where under the DeSantis administration, you've had the content standards, particularly the civic standards at the state level, have really done a good job in setting the framework for what's taught in the Florida K-12, public K-12 schools. And then I will also add, in Louisiana, the new education superintendent, Cade Brumley, got rid of a horribly woke draft social studies standards and replaced it with a quite good, social studies standard that, good bipartisan, both of them, Florida and Louisiana, they're good bipartisan documents that have traditional history and civics. And it's terribly important. Social studies standards are the single most important document in this entire education administration world. It depends on the state, but they have great informal or formal influence about what's taught in each school district. Some states give more independence to the school districts, others less, but the standards still sort of tell you what it should be, what the teacher training should be, what your curriculum ought to do. So focusing on the state standards, focusing on the education department and what it produces is absolutely crucial as a target for political reform. Now, how do you get there? Aside from electing the right governor who cares about this stuff, and I must say, having education rise to the top of the priority list and this particular sort of culture war aspects of it, as opposed to what are the costs, what do you have school choice, it's really important that it be not just, oh, we're in favor of this, but it be in the, this is a priority, we will deal with this, the short list of issues. You get everybody interested. You get grassroots activists to care about this. You get new school board members elected. You get state representatives to hold hearings and call the education department head on the, you know, in for a hearing and say, what is going on? You have legislation. We have model legislation at the Civics Alliance, which will set the parameters for good education. You know, you can have, that is, there are a number of bills and laws out there. You can, you will have a decent skeleton of US history with primary documents. Once that law is passed in the broad outline, that's the statutory basis to have a really detailed social studies standard and then the improved curricula. And then you've got to have stuff like transparency and accountability, have parents be able to see what's actually being taught to their kids, so as to prevent the usual local sabotage, which is how any bureaucracy resists reform put in from outside. And that follow through at the end is absolutely crucial. Every parent, every school board member has to pay attention to their child education. They can't just trust that it'll be done right anymore, alas and unfortunately.
So, are you seeing, as you mentioned Florida, you mentioned Louisiana, we've discussed what happened in Virginia, sort of just, you know, you thought they were going to go super far left and continue going that direction. You know, you saw in the last year's election, very different. Are you seeing advances from what you're trying to do more than in just sort of the hotbed of Florida?
I should say the most important thing is to say that the country has woken up about the importance of education. Only, alas, a relatively few people were paying attention through to 2020. They have realized that, you know, education has consequences. Education is down, you know, upstream of culture, upstream of politics. They have realized, unfortunately, that we have set up a self-perpetuating education system which has, in effect, staffing educated the education elites and a great deal of the governmental elites and indeed private sector elites. We need to restore our education system so as to restore, so as to re-educate a new generation of Americans to staff all of these aspects of our elites and institutions and reorient them to appreciation of the American Republic and service of its ideals rather than for ideological revolution.
Here's the thing, when because I know, like, we have people that listen to the show that are left, right, center. Whenever I hear the term re-educate, reorient, it is not a great connotation. Yeah, so When it comes to that, how do you, because that's not a selling term, right? Like when you say we're going to re-educate left and right, people are like, I don't think so. How do you sell what it is that you're doing to the masses or to people in general?
Yes. So for anybody who's listening there and wants to play gotcha, I now officially withdraw that word. Educate for liberty. That is important. The traditional American education was to educate students to be able to make up their own minds, to be able to think through what's happening, to judge, first their schoolwork, then American history, then the world of politics outside. So you give them a large amount of the facts of history and civics, so that they are able to have the background to judge anything new that comes along. And you then teach them to be able to think, to argue both sides of the issue. And most importantly, and this gets back to the moderation, to be able to argue an opponent whom you are granting is just as moral as you are, just as intelligent as you are, just as in command of the facts as you are, but has differed. And this is what persuasion is about. You persuade somebody who you is an equal, you acknowledge as a fellow citizen. And you don't assume you're teaching somebody who is ignorant or evil and bringing them to good. And when I said re-education, what I meant is, unfortunately, a great deal of our education system is based upon the presumption that there is one morality, and the only way to deal with other people is to hector them, instruct them in what is true, what is good, what is moral, and to warn them away from any disagreement, because that will make them, you know, benighted, evil, ignorant. People should be educated to be free and to respect their fellow citizens to be free. It is very difficult, ultimately, to, once people have been educated to not have this point of view from through the age of 18 and more, I don't quite know ultimately what education system can undo that. We will get rid of the word re-education, but somehow people who have been educated for an ideological view of your education, of political debate, somehow one needs to be able to open up their minds to the point of view that the people who disagree with them, you should treat them decently and as, you know, moral and political equals. Now, what the word is for that, I will sort of leave for the moment, but we have to be able, I suppose, to persuade people who've been educated to disdain liberty. We need to educate people to become reacquainted with the value of liberty.
Yeah, I like that, reacquainted with the value of liberty.
You know, you could do the Yoda thing. You must unlearn what you have learned. Or
hey, there you go. Yeah.
You know, I was when you were discussing all this, I had thoughts of Ben Shapiro appearing on Bill Maher's show, and just recently, Sean Penn appeared on Sean Hannity's show, and you know they were civil discussions, because mm-hmm. it's like, look, you know, yes, we differ in just about everything, but they talked with respect to each other. It was very civil, and you know, I learned a lot more from that than some of the interviews I see against Dr. Jordan Peterson, the way they're, oh, so you're saying you hate women, is that what you're trying, you know, that type of discussion. So I you know, I agree with what you're saying. It is important to have these civil discussions.
I'm going to add to you a word term from philosophy in particular, the principle of charity, which is charitable understanding. Try to understand the best possible version of your opponent's arguments, come up with the best possible version of your opponent's arguments, and argue against that. It's something I think we can use in the broader world and not just in the departments of philosophy.
Yeah. I think the biggest problem in the public education system is exactly what you are tackling, which is activism. It's like you have replaced civics knowledge with civic activism. And now you are going into activism without knowledge. And I think one of the key things is one of the things, because you give a lot of illustrations and quotes from some of these, you know, like the Gilder Lehrman, the 1619, you have 15 of them, but they use the word democracy a lot. And rarely, if ever, and I would probably say never, use the word republic. And so therefore you have no understanding of how the country came to be and what it's established for and how the republic works. It is only democracy through the concept of majority rule. And if you have the majority rule, that means, you know, whoever is loudest. And it goes back to sort of the Athenian democracy. Whoever is louder, you know, they're the ones who win the argument. I think you're tackling the right things.
I want to be a touch more cynical about that. Democracy is also used for whatever is imposed by any judge or bureaucrat. It doesn't even need, and when the majority of the people disagree, that's populism and evil and must be, you know, opposed in the name of democracy, which does take some intellectual gymnastics, but I would say that is part of what's out there too.
Right. It's utilized only when it's beneficial to the group, whoever's, I guess, yelling the loudest.
Actually, I think that's what Sparta did. The Spartans were whoever yelled the loudest.
Was it the Spartans?
Mm-hmm. At least, unless he can correct me.
I'm pretty sure you're wrong.
Nope, I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Pretty sure
the Spartans were based on who was the loudest. The Athenians was based on majority. So, you know, don't make me.
Maybe you need to read Socrates or Plato's Republic again.
Actually, I think I read Thucydides.
Thucydides Republic? Yeah. And he didn't write the Republic.
No, idiot.
I am going to make a shout out for the two of you. Paul Rahe, who teaches at Hillsdale and has done some excellent works on Republics Ancient and Modern, is either in the middle of or finished with a series on the history of Sparta, which is new, excellent, the latest word in academic scholarship. So I direct everybody who's interested in Sparta to Paul Rahe and his works.
Okay. Yeah, we might have to mention that one on our book recommendations.
Absolutely.
But, I wanted to say Xenophon also. I did read Xenophon, so or Xenophon or whatever.
Whatever. Yeah. However you say it. homeschooling, and this is, we advocate for homeschooling. We're like, hey, if you can do it, please do it. And there is sort of the crux of the matter, is a lot of times parents feel like they can't do it because they don't know how to teach or they don't know where to get material. But the fact is, there's so much material out there. Give parents an idea of where they can go, get some of this material, and where they should lean.
Okay, unfortunately, I'm not an expert in homeschooling. I want to reiterate to you what you just said. There is an enormous amount of material out there. The question is choosing it yourself. I guess I would say for what we're interested in terms of American history and civics, you've mentioned Wilfred McClay. His Land of Hope is an excellent textbook. That's a great place to start. You want a good standard textbook of American history. That's really good. I am going to say, look at the Hillsdale's curriculum first. That has versions of civics and civics in particular. They have elementary school versions, middle school versions, and high school versions, including with loads of primary sources included. This is their 1776 curriculum. And they do, I believe, have a textbook I have discovered. I'm blanking on the name as well, but you know, which goes with that. We the People isn't bad for nuts and bolts. It is a bit soft, I think, on some things, you know, moderation and compromise, where I would not necessarily have made some of those moderations and compromises in that case, but it's still not bad for nuts and bolts. But so I would say, if you start with Wilfred McClay's Land of Hope and the Hillsdale 1776 curriculum, that's a really good place to start. And I guess, and for the positive version of Black history as part of America's great history of liberty, a 1776 Unites Lessons Plans.
You know, I have one of the 1776 books. I wonder if that's the one that you're referring to. I'll have to take a look at it after the show is over. So,
yeah, you do that.
Well.
I'm excited for you. I'm excited that you're going to get to do that. Hey, David, where can people find the Learning for Self-Government, and what do you hope that they sort of pull from all that?
You can find it, both at the Pioneer Institute, but then also, it's actually both on civicsalliance.org, the home of the Civics Alliance, and then it's also at nas.org, the home of the National Association of Scholars. And, you know, and if you Google Learning for Self-Government and perhaps David Randall in good quotation marks, You ought to find it that way too. What people should take away from it, as I say, is that you don't need to start from zero. There is a lot of good civics and American history material out there. You need to, every parent should exercise their own judgment, of course, and they should take the time to read it themselves, but they should think, if I make that investment, I will have good material I can use for my children. I can build upon it. This is not a hopeless endeavor. It's an entirely doable endeavor. We have the bricks for everybody to work with. Everybody needs to make their own hut to build an education for their children. But it's entirely doable at this point in time. Americans are resourceful. We've done a good work in the last generation. You can use all this good material and do well by your kids.
So use the bricks to build your own hut, not take them and smash people's windows, businesses, stuff.
Yeah, smashing people's windows is not the moderate course of action.
So David, last question. The painting above the fireplace hearth, what is that? Is that Thomas Kincaid? What?
Since this is a Zoom, I don't know. But I will say that as part of everybody's American history and education and civics, they should look at all the great American paintings done over the last few centuries. The course of empire is always a good warning about, I think that's Durand, about what goes wrong when you become decadent. Albert Bierstadt has the great paintings of the American West. Winslow Homer is the great painter of New England of the Civil War. Edward Hopper, early 20th century America. We have a beautiful civics lesson in art as well, in art, in music, in all of the wonderful American culture of the last few centuries. America is fun. And part of the civics lesson actually is, it's not just learning about the government, it's learning about all the wonderful things that Americans have done, how they've danced, how they've sung. Judy Garland and Over the Rainbow is part of America and our American civics, our heritage as well. So America is a land you can dance to from joy. And that's part of what everybody should know.
Well, that's good stuff, David. Thanks so much for joining. Now, if I had to choose, I would have to go with Louis Armstrong's version, but hey, whatever. It's no big deal.
What about that Hawaiian one? That was pretty good.
Yeah, he did. He did good with the ukulele.
Yeah.
You know, he died shortly after that.
Yes. I saw the video at the end where they dumped his ashes in the,
yeah, he ocean. Was a pretty large guy.
Yeah.
Not healthy, but great. Great rendition. Yeah. I really liked it. Dave, thanks for joining us. And we greatly appreciate all the work that you're doing. Thank you so much. And all the best to you, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, that's a conversation I think was needed right at the end of the school year. As I said prior, I think this is just something that people really need to think about. And that's why I was asking, like, do you see some changes being made other than sort of, like I said, the hotbed or the lightning rod that is Florida.
What do you think? The things, and we discussed this, is that he's not going to be successful, or his group is not going to be successful, as long as the school boards are controlled by these woke individuals who want to push these left-wing agendas. So first, I think we're going to have to see a change in the school boards. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to see a change in the legislatures, where they quit pushing CRT, quit pushing anything that is anti-American. And then once that's done, then we have to make sure that students are taught history. And once they're taught history, then they can be taught civics.
Yeah.
Because you can't really appreciate your country or your civilization if you're against it to begin with. So,
yeah, that's the thing is, and people will say, "Oh, yeah, well, the other side is wanting to push whitewash history." And it's like, well, no, we already have proof like a number of times that that is not the case. One, people hate on the 1776 Commission, but it's very straightforward on the good, the bad, the ugly of history. Mary Graybar, she did her Debunking the 1619 Project, which I thoroughly enjoyed that book. It leaves, it doesn't whitewash anything. We had Don Fraser on, I think it was last season, and they were talking about like the 1836 commission for Texas, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, advocates and activists are saying, oh, you know, they're wanting to whitewash. And he's like, no, we're not whitewashing it. And, you know, it's pretty straightforward that they're not. Yeah. And that's the thing is, it's like, since the left is so hardcore freaking left, they think automatically any pushback is, well, you're wanting to whitewash and do away with, like, no, it's just teaching history and civics,
yeah,
and learning how to think and just teaching it properly without an agenda. That's what is going on. These are actual historians who are actually wanting history to be taught, not activists wanting theories, mm-hmm, and intersectionality and all this horse crap. It's like, no, keep that for your college, you know, whatever thing that you're wanting to do in college or major in, F it. I don't care. Do that. But when it comes to high school and it comes to junior high, just teach freaking history and civics and government as it should, without an agenda. You don't like it? Homeschool your kid and teach them critical race theory and all this garbage, and then let them develop into whatever type of person that you want them to.
Well, and I also think it's important that we tell people that CRT is full of crap,
mm-hmm,
that the 1619 Project is full of crap.
Yeah, it's garbage.
You know, we had a controversy here in Texas regarding, I think, the University of Texas San Antonio, Come and Take It. They had a thing about Come and Take It, and they immediately turned it into an anti-Hispanic crusade. And I said to them, do you understand that, like, when the Texas Revolution started, that Tejano participation was very high,
mm-hmm,
and even when it, I mean, throughout the war, it was very high. Yep. Tejanos fled because they knew Santa Anna was a butcher. They fought at when they captured Bayar under. They fought with Ben Milam. They fought with Jim Bowie. Once again, you had Lorenzo de Zavala. You had a couple of Tejanos who signed the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. You had an entire unit fight at San Jacinto under Once Again,
yeah,
and you know they were pretty brutal towards the Mexican army.
Yeah.
So when you throw that in, then people, you know, like the Tejanos will be like, hey, you know what? You know, Texas history, yeah, is my history. It's the same, exactly, with the United States. If black individuals realized that there were black soldiers who fought in the Revolutionary War, mm-hmm, under George Washington or, yeah, under at Bunker Hill,
mm-hmm,
then they realize, you know, the Revolutionary War is my history.
Right.
And then once you embrace, let's say, the United States. I mean, look, we're going to say it, okay? I'm going to say it. Yes, I am pro-United States. Yes, I want...
How dare you?
I want... I know.
Isn't that stupid, though, that you have to even say it's right. Like, look, F you. Like, you don't like that? Like, then don't watch our show, yeah, please.
I mean, I don't want to say don't watch our show, but understand why the position that we take. Moderation. Moderation. We have to understand, you know, but I want people...
It's almost like it was scripted.
I know, but not, it's not. But, you know, it's like, okay, understand where we're coming from.
Yeah.
Yes, we are pro-United States. We are patriotic.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have our reasons. So, and we're going to... And it's being pushed aside for a different agenda. And what we're trying to say is, don't shove this crap, yeah, on kids. Don't shove,
right,
enough already. Every single movies, TV shows,
sports. You're creating a spirit and a society of ungratefulness and of ingratitude.
And division. And division
well,
among
that's what
people.
That happens. Yeah. Like, it's like your entire basis of reality and American reality is going to be based on, I'm not thankful for... Do you understand how good it is in this country, even with the crappy administration, even, mm-hmm, with the jokes that we got going on, you know, over the past few years? Like, give me a break. this is still the, like, where else do you want to live?
Well, you know,
compared to what, right?
One of the things that we have discussed is, and you know, yeah, we're not going to whitewash our history. Mm-mm. We'll discuss our history. We sometimes don't have to mention certain things because, believe me, they're pushing it everywhere. So yeah. you know about certain things that this country has done, but what we'll point out is that, you know, that there were things that occurred that if you take things in perspective, you know, like we talked about the Nisei, the Japanese who were interned. If you knew about the Niihau incident, then you're going to kind of understand why. We're not condoning what happened, mm-hmm. but don't condemn the people in the 40s based on your standards, because then, you know, 80 years from now, somebody's going to condemn you because you might have a pet or, you know, you eat meat. How dare you?
Yeah.
You know, you're killing, you know, and so they're going to judge you and call you pretty harsh things, but take things in perspective and understand certain things. And yes, there is going to be some moderation. We understand where your opponent is not evil or hell-bent on evil. They just have a different view. And, you know, civics coupled with history, I think that will, I really do believe that will end the division that we are seeing in this country.
Right. Just a proper retelling. Yes. Of history and civics. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen.
And an accurate one, too.
Yeah, unbelievable. Book and movie recommendation. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to start off while you finish up. Can you pull the microphone to you, please? How long has that been away?
I don't know. Did you know, you're the producer. You're the one who should be.
This is what I'm talking about. You know what? Even if that was away from you the entire time, I don't freaking care. It's probably for the best. People can't hear what you're saying. All right, ladies and gentlemen, here is my book and movie recommendation. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Notes of Debates in the Federal Convention of 1787, reported by James Madison. Of course, that's a super long way to say it. Just constitutional debate, the notes on the Constitutional Convention by James Madison. Search that in Amazon or in Google, whatever, and you'll be able to pull it up. Probably be able to pull it up and have be able to read it for free. It's probably free by now. I know that the Federalist Papers are free to read online if you just Google the Federalist Papers. This, I don't go to Barnes & Noble anymore because they're stupid. But if you still go to Barnes & Noble, this is a great compilation. It's the Constitution of the United States, along with a lot of other things, including the Federalist Papers. It's a great read. Tons of great information. Can't encourage you enough to have your high schoolers read this, in particular, college students too. I don't know why I said in particular. And also, adults. If you've never read the Federalist Papers, highly encourage. Both of those. My movie recommendation is not a movie. In fact, it's not even a TV show, but we did mention Hillsdale College a number of times. They have online courses at Hillsdale College. They are really, really well done. They range from philosophy of the ancient Greeks to the Constitution to World War II. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Victor Davis Hanson does a thing on his, I think it was the Second World Wars. So, good stuff. Ton of stuff that in there free. So go sign up. Hillsdale.edu, I believe. All right, that's all.
You know, you could also go watch the Sons of History. They've got quite a bit of great videos that you could watch. You know, just got to throw that in there.
YouTube. That is very true.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Remember when we dressed up?
Yeah, I'm glad we don't do that all the time. That was hot.
All the time or anymore?
Well.
We haven't done it anymore.
Well, you know, those, since the beginning. Those stockings?
Yeah.
That was
tough.
Yeah. I prefer shorts, t-shirt. You know. Right. Anyway. All right. Now mine, I've got quite a bit. I'm gonna do my movie recommendations first. John Adams, I know I've mentioned them before, the HBO miniseries that came out a few years back, starring Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney. Reason for that is because based on this discussion, it's important to understand what the United States went through. It wasn't a simple, okay, let's just sign a document, Declaration of Independence, yeah, we're free. No, There was a struggle. There was a huge struggle. There was a long, long war, the Revolutionary War. It was like an 8-year war that, you know, we didn't know if we were going to win. We had moments where we came close to losing. So if you understand the struggle that took place to get us where we are, you'll appreciate your country more. So that's I'm going to recommend. Now, one that's totally off the subject, based on the history, week in history, Sink the Bismarck. I earlier talked about what happened this week, 1941, the sinking of the Bismarck. The movie, it stars Kenneth Moore and Dana Winter. It's a pretty much a British-English movie. Not too many Americans in there. The guy who used to play M in the earlier James Bond movies, he's in it. So watch it and kind of gives you an idea of the drama that took place with the sinking of the Bismarck and all the stuff that took place. And it does show the hood blowing up, by the way. Hmm. Pretty, pretty cool. All right, now, in terms of books, this is our last episode of the season, so okay. I'm going to throw out a lot of books for you. Any history book on the Revolutionary War, there's quite a few of them. There's David McCullough's 1776. There's Robert Leckie's book on the Revolutionary War, anything by Gordon Wood. Read those and you'll have an appreciation for this country. Now, once you know the history and you appreciate the country, it's time to learn the civics aspect of it and how the government works. So I really like this book. It's kind of hard to find the hardback edition is kind of hard to find. You can find the paperback, but it's called The Documents of the Revolution. Now, this has everything. This has common sense. It has the complete Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers.
There you go.
Read the Anti-Federalists. There were quite a few. Patrick Henry, Samuel Adams. Is that his right name? Yeah.
Yeah.
God, Sam. Yeah, I just go by Sam Adams. Samuel Adams.
Don't even say Samuel. You say Samuel.
Sam Adams, yeah. A lot of those guys were anti-federalists. They just did not trust any type of centralized government. You have those. You have the Articles of the Confederation in here. You have the Constitution. You have the Bill of Rights. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, all that is in what I was saying, except mm-hmm. without the anti-federalist papers.
Yeah, so I really like this one. It has them all. So reading this, you'll kind of get a understanding. Now, there are going to be some others. This is the 1776 report, which you could find. I think this was under the Trump presidency. It was to combat the 1619 Project. Speaking of the 1619 Project, Dr. Mary Graybar's book, Debunking the 1619 Project. Now, our history, our civics, our government, our way of life, our thinking is all under assault. Well, Dr. Mary Graybar has written two very good books, mm-hmm. the Debunking the 1619 Project and Debunking Howard Zinn.
Yeah.
And you've got to know about both of those, Howard Zinn and 1619 Project. Otherwise, you know, they're going to attack what you believe in and they're going to make you crumble just a bit.
Yeah, so it's interesting because your next book, like our founders,
mm-hmm.
played off of these guys that you're going to mention.
Yes.
The 1619 Project plays off of Howard Zinn.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your founder?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you get a chance, there is a book. I think I got this at Barnes & Noble. It's called The Essential Wisdom of the Founding Fathers. You learn quite a bit. I mean, it's like, wow, I didn't even think about that. And you can understand, you know, where our freedom is not given to us by the government.
Mm-hmm.
The government is to protect the freedom which we already possess.
Yeah.
That's God-given. That's inalienable. They can't take away. If government gives you freedom, then they can take it away.
That's right.
All right. Now, the Founding Fathers. Dr. Joe Wolverton has written a couple of really good. I love watching his podcasts, or not his podcasts, but his videos
clips, yeah.
on Instagram. This book right here is called The Founder's Recipe. You know, the Founding Fathers had to get their source from someone. Well, Dr. Joe Wolverton put together many of the famous and not so famous philosophers and historians and politicians, their sayings, the things that they said, like Sydney Algernon Sydney. I can Algernon never get Sydney.
Them. Hmm? Algernon Sydney.
Algernon Sydney. I can never get his name right. But you know who is he? Well, you'll know once you read this book. Mm-hmm. He wrote another book called What Degree of Madness.
Yep.
And you got to read if you read Dr. Joe Wolverton, you're gonna learn a lot, and you'll be able to defend your country from those that are looking to destroy it. Mm-hmm. The last one, and I'm not going to sit and say that this is particularly what you have to go by. This is what I went by, the New Testament. And you can do the Old Testament too. But, mm-hmm. you know, you got to believe in something.
Yeah.
Or you're going to, what's that saying from Rambo?
You got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything.
Yeah, something like that. Or die for nothing. Or I don't know what is Rambo.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, for me, this laid the foundation. Now, I'm not saying you know, I've got a very good atheist friend in Phoenix mm-hmm. who is very patriotic, but he doesn't believe in God. But you know, if the Bible works for you, great. If the Tanakh, if the Quran, if mysticism, you know, any type of religion gives you a foundation where there's more to life than, you know, than what you see. You're not just existing.
Yeah.
You know, you got to look at other people. And,
a moral foundation.
A moral foundation.
A moral foundation.
Right. Which, now, if John Adams and Benjamin Franklin both stated that, you know, for our Constitution, for freedom to work, we have to be a disciplined people. We have to be a religious people. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, the freedom that you acquire, you're going to abuse it. But if you're laid with a good moral foundation and you're disciplined, once you are a fully free person, say you're 21, then you behave like a responsible adult. Yeah.
And your freedom is not based on debauchery, which is where we are now.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not even about moral freedom. Like, moral freedom requires responsibility. Debauchery and freedom doesn't require responsibility. You deflect responsibility. That's the big difference.
Well, you know, because I'm not going to say, well, you know, you can't go to New Orleans or Las Vegas.
There's a difference in debauchery and going and visiting places. There's a difference.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a difference in like somebody getting drunk one night and then living a life of being an absolute drunk. Like, there's a complete difference.
Yes, exactly. You
know, there's a difference in being a prostitute and then getting whatever on the weekend, you know, randomly.
Yeah.
Not randomly.
Without having to pay for it.
Right. There's a difference. That's what I'm saying. It's like, we're living in a society that's like, oh, what is freedom? Freedom is getting to do whatever it is that you want to do. And it's like, no, that's a road to destruction.
Yeah. Right, I mean, if you're in your own home, you
can
do whatever.
That's not how a republic works. That's not, freedom comes with responsibility.
Yeah.
So, but that's a whole nother conversation. I think we've been on this show for the final episode long enough, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a ton of information. Follow us. We'll remain on social media and everything. We're just going to be taking a break for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope that y'all enjoy the summer. Till then.
I was going to say, if you know, we mentioned earlier that we are on, subscribe to our YouTube channel, watch our videos. We're on every major podcast. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. We're on Twitter. And we have our very own website, www.thesonsofhistory.com. And if you want to remind people about our newsletter.
Yeah, newsletter. DM us on Facebook or Instagram or shoot us an email at thesonsofhistory@gmail.com and we'll add you to the newsletter. And that's it. We hope that you enjoy the rest of your summer. Please invest your time wisely. Maybe read some of these books.
I'm gonna say,
make a good friend.
Yes. Yeah. I know we banter.
Iron sharpens iron, as they say.
I thought fire.
No, iron sharpens iron is a proverb in the Bible. Didn't you just have this? Oh yeah, you got Psalms and Proverbs in there.
Well, you'll notice that this has never been opened.
Or it may be Ecclesiastes. But I think it's Proverbs.
Actually, no, I haven't read this one. I do.
All right, that's it for the show, ladies and gentlemen. Bye bye. Have a great week and summer.